May it please the court, counsel, students, and faculty. As I stated, my name is Cynthia Liu, Deputy Alternate Public Defender. I'm representing the appellant Edwin Humberto Artiga Morales. This is my first appearance before this court, and I want to say it's an honor to appear here with this distinguished panel. It's also an honor to appear in Douglas County for this event. I would like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Today I'm asking the court to reverse Mr. Artiga Morales' conviction for the following reasons. First of all, this was a close case regarding evidence. It was largely based on eyewitness identification. The victim in this case admits to using meth that day. He was using meth daily for several years. He first identified the co-defendant as the shooter in the case on the day of the shooting. Almost 2 months later, after he comes out of a medically induced coma and on heavy pain medications, he's interviewed by Detective Chad Crow, and then at that point identifies Mr. Artiga Morales as the shooter about two months later. The other witness was a driver who was driving by in a vehicle with her daughter going about 15 to 20 miles per hour. The shooting occurred in a matter of seconds, and she basically identified Mr. Artiga Morales just prior to the grand jury hearing when she was shown one photo, and that one photo was of Mr. Artiga Morales. She was never able to identify the second person with the two people that she saw running away. The third witness is basically a statement made by an acquaintance, Ms. Patricia Flores, who basically indicated that Mr. Artiga Morales made an admission to her that he was involved in the shooting. And what's important to note about Ms. Flores' testimony is she admitted that she was using meth daily during that time when she heard these admissions. And she actually was in jail on her third felony conviction that she was facing. She had just been to prison on her second felony conviction, been dishonorably discharged from parole. And for her testimony, she was given a stipulation of probation by the district attorney's office. Interestingly, during the testimony, Detective Chad Crow did not deny telling Ms. Flores that her testimony was important and that this case might be weak otherwise without it. He said he couldn't remember stating that to her, but did not deny that he could have said that to her. As I stated, there was no physical evidence in this case. There was no gun that was ever found to link Mr. Artiga Morales to the incident. The first issue I want to actually discuss is the PowerPoint presentation that was denied by the district court. Defense put on their expert, Dr. Deborah Davis, who is an eyewitness identification expert. She was denied the use of her PowerPoint. As this court knows, this world is becoming a very visual and video-oriented place. It's a very powerful modern tool for communication. When you look at social media, everyone talks about Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, MySpace. Everyone sees videos on YouTube, even for instructional purposes.
But Ms. Liu, my understanding was that the judge had nothing against PowerPoints. It's just the contents of the slides of what was in the PowerPoint was her concern. So am I incorrect on that?
No, that is correct, Your Honor. The court disallowed it, indicating that she felt that the information in it was inflammatory and argumentative. However, the very point of having an expert witness is to educate and explain to the jury, and by its very nature, the expert witness in their testimony tends to confirm or refute the truthfulness of a witness or evidence that's being presented.
But she got to testify. She testified as to what the PowerPoint had on it.
She was allowed to testify. However, we feel that her testimony was less effective because she wasn't able to utilize the tool of a PowerPoint presentation.
But our standard of review is abuse of discretion. Why was this abuse of discretion on behalf of Judge Barry?
It was abuse of discretion because in other cases, when let's say we have a case that involves DNA, and DNA was found on the crime scene. The DNA experts all the time use PowerPoint during their presentations to the jury to educate, because the issue is DNA a counterintuitive information for the average person to understand the complexities of DNA? It's not. By that same token, eyewitness identification and issues involving that, including issues of memory, recall, what the person is focused on looking at. Is the person really focused on the gun, or is the person really focused on the face of the individual? These were all important questions in this case because this case was largely based upon eyewitness identification. And the defense has a right to put on their evidence in the way they need to put it on to present their case to the jury. And that is why we felt that the district court abused her discretion by not allowing the expert to use it, thereby diluting her effectiveness with the jury in educating them and discussing eyewitness identification.
Was part of Judge Barry's determination based upon the fact that the PowerPoint slides perhaps weren't timely produced?
She did address that issue, and that was one of the objections brought by the state. However, in my recollection of looking at the transcripts, the district court found that the presentation would be argumentative and inflammatory, was my recollection of the final disposition of the case. And I had analogized the use of autopsy photos as well, because in murder trials, autopsy photos are often used, or actually they're always used, and they're very graphic in detail. They're showing entry wounds, exit wounds, they're showing organs that have been removed from the body, which, you know, to some attorneys, after they practice for a few years, they may get used to it, but when a jury sees those autopsy photos, they always turn away. And those have historically been allowed to be used in these types of proceedings.
But is that not at the discretion of the court?
That is with the discretion of the court as well. And our point would be that the state, in the discretion of the court, is allowed to use autopsy photos. The state, in using DNA experts, are allowed to use the PowerPoint presentation. We're simply suggesting that the defense, when they bring a defense expert, should be allowed to use PowerPoint presentations as well to educate the jury.
Ms. Liu, the theory behind this expert was to question the capability of the state's prosecuting witnesses, or the state's witnesses' ability to perceive and their ability to state correctly what the facts were. So Dr. Davis was called to call into question, I guess, the ability of witnesses to accurately perceive events when they're either under the stress of distance or time or a stressful event.
Is that correct? That's correct, Justice.
All right. My understanding is that the state articulated some number of slides that it considered to be irrelevant. There was a slide that dealt with the question of failure of memory of time, that media reports distort memory, or that confidence enhancing by the police can distort memory. Those slides were excluded. How was your client prejudiced by the exclusion of those slides when Dr. Davis still testified as to those subject matters?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the court should defer to experts in what tools and what information they need to present to the jury to educate them. The court would not be an expert in eyewitness identification. I certainly would not be an expert in eyewitness identification. Therefore, our position would be that the court should defer to the expert on what tools they need to educate the jury so that the defense can present their case.
So doesn't the court have some gatekeeper function?
I believe the court does have the abuse of discretion. However, I don't think you can put a bright line rule. This information, as I stated, is not counterintuitive. I wouldn't be able to get up even after hearing a DNA expert explain DNA, be able to explain it to...
Your position would seem to be we should just let everything in.
My position would be that in this particular case, when the defense has an expert witness, that we just be allowed to have our expert witness be able to present and educate their case as part of our defense.
Yeah, Ms. Little, let me ask you this, because I think this is a very important issue. And we had a case, I believe Justice Hardesty authored, called Higgs versus State, where we talked about expert witnesses and the judge's role in allowing or disallowing certain testimony. And how does that case play into your analysis?
Well, in the Higgs versus State case, the analysis was discussing the admissibility for the expert testimony. And in that case, the court had declined to adopt the Daubert standard. And the court found no reason to limit the factors the trial judges may consider in determining expert witness testimony admissibility. Basically, there are three requirements required for an expert witness to testify. He or she must be qualified in the area of the scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge. Specialized knowledge must assist the truer fact in understanding the evidence or determine a fact and issue, and his or her testimony must be limited to matters within the scope of his or her specialized knowledge. In this case, Dr. Davis was allowed to testify, so therefore, Higgs, to that degree, was followed because she was allowed to testify. Her testimony was not prevented or was not prohibited during the proceeding. Our argument is whether or not the denial of her PowerPoint then diluted what she could have conveyed to the court, because the world is such a visual world now, and a lot of people learn more by seeing as well as hearing.
You want to reserve the rest of your time?
I would like to do that. Okay. So at this point, I would submit my other issues based on the briefs.
All right, you have a chance for rebuttal. On behalf of the state of Nevada.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Plater for the state of Nevada. In terms of the quality and the quantity of the evidence that was first presented to you by Ms. Liu, that's irrelevant in this case because there's no argument as to the sufficiency of the evidence. They don't argue that there was insufficient evidence to sustain the conviction in this case. There's no argument that there was cumulative error, which normally looks at as one of the factors that whether the evidence supporting the conviction was based on a lot of evidence or slim evidence. So the idea that this was a close case is not relevant. We submitted was not a close case. We had three witnesses to the shooting. We had the victim, we had the lay witness who was driving by the shooting, and then we had the person to whom the defendant admitted that he had shot the victim. So it's not a case of close evidence. Now, going to this argument that the district court should have let Deborah Davis present her PowerPoint presentation to the jury, the court is correct. The Supreme Court doesn't look at this case and ask itself, what would we have done had Deborah Davis come into the courtroom and asked to present the PowerPoint presentation? That decision is left to the sole discretion of the trial judge. When the issue becomes ripe, when the defendant is convicted and the issue comes before this court, the court asks itself, could the district court have rendered the decision it did within the bounds of reason, or did it abuse its discretion? Is there no reasonable way the district court could have justified its decision in limiting Dr. Davis's testimony? Now, the district court judge did not say Dr. Davis couldn't testify at all about memory issues. She did. She testified about the limits of memory, the things that affect memory, and she did so freely in this case. In fact, she went into many areas that the district court said she shouldn't go into. But what the district court did is she said you can't use the PowerPoint presentation for a number of reasons. And that's the issue in this case, not whether the PowerPoint presentation was admissible in a general sense, but whether it was the district court judge properly confined certain points or elements of what the expert wanted to present. And the court decided, well, we're not going to let you present the PowerPoint because it's highly argumentative, it's inflammatory, it's prejudicial against the state, and here's why. There were things in the presentation that said things like the number one cause for wrongful convictions is improper eyewitness testimony. Dr. Davis wanted to present testimony that convictions based on eyewitness testimony are often inaccurate, and eyewitnesses are often inaccurate. She wanted to testify that the majority of jurors give great weight to eyewitness testimony and often convict solely on that type of testimony. Well, we think the district court was correct. This essentially directed a verdict in favor of the defendant, or at least on the issue of eyewitness testimony, which was the basis of this case, because there was really no physical evidence that tied the victim to the defendant's crime.
Mr. Plater, can I ask you a couple about two other issues in the case that Ms. Liu, I briefed but didn't have a chance to get to? The one on the jury selection, the information about the jury veneer. And again, my understanding, the jury veneer is like the group of maybe 30 people and are potential jurors, and then they're whittled down to 12 jurors that serve in a criminal trial. Now, Mr. Artiga Morales was claiming he had inadequate information about the proposed jurors here. And I'd like you to know, especially since the students here, I think once they turn 18 and if they're U.S. citizens, they can do jury duty. So I don't like that. How much information are the parties entitled to receive about the background of prospective jurors?
So before trial in this case, the defense made a motion. And the motion was based on the idea that we want all the information that the state has about all the potential jurors in this case, and that is unavailable to the defense. The state opposed that motion, and the district court denied the defendant's motion. And there was no specific information the defendant wanted about the jurors. It just wanted all the information the state had about these people who might end up serving as jurors.
Did they not have their own investigators?
I know for a fact they do have investigators. Whether they employed them in this particular case, I don't know. And I don't know what type of information they obtained through their investigators.
Yes, Mr. Plater, let me be more specific, because in our briefing, this one area seemed to pop up, and that was the use of scope information. And did the DA use scope information on the veneer?
You're talking about the NCIC criminal records?
Yes.
Of potential jurors?
Yes.
And that is part of the record. There is a representation that we had the criminal history of the potential jurors in this case.
Did you or did you not?
Did we have that information? I assume we did. I think there's a representation that we did. I assume we did.
Is that available? Because I know in many jurisdictions, it's not available to defense unless it's ordered by the court for the prosecutor.
Right. I can only answer that if you allow me to go outside the record, because the record doesn't address it. I have knowledge about it, about our office's policy, and about how that information is available and restrictions on it, but it's not part of the record. So it's up to you.
I'll just say that maybe after this you'll get a supplemental briefing request then. Don't go outside of the record.
Okay. No, that's fine.
Mr. Plater, I was concerned maybe I should point out I
haven't even got to my main argument in response to your question.
And I'll be quick. I just got a jury summons. I live in Carson City, and I received a jury summons to report for jury duty to Carson City.
Well,
so,
district attorney,
can we get his criminal history?
Yeah. I don't know. I was kind of curious about this issue and background, because by the way, judges can get called in just like anybody else. You know, so I don't know if they'll let me sit.
Perhaps before Justice Gibbons is excused, we could all get a copy of his criminal history.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
No, the short answer to whether the district court correctly denied the motion to reveal all this information about potential jurors is that it's prohibited by law in the state of Nevada. So normally, the question of whether voir dire's properly done and the limits on it and scope of voir dire is usually within the discretion of the trial court.
But doesn't that raise an issue of fundamental fairness, almost a due process issue at the forefront, if it's something the state has access to that, and we're not talking Brady, but a fundamental due process, an equal footing when you start with as you're selecting the people who are going to make the decision about guilt or innocence?
Our United States Supreme Court has said that we have to turn over certain material to the defendant before a trial. And it's limited that type of evidence to, as you said, Brady material. Brady material is material that's exculpatory.
Here is this little area that we've talked about outside of the record, but this is a particular point. the defense can't get based upon our laws unless it's provided by order of the court or by the DA. Why should the DA have it and not the defense when we're looking at an equal playing field? The person's only accused of a crime. They're not guilty of a crime till after the trial.
State statute NRS 174.2352A provides that the defendant is not permitted any document that involves the preparation, investigation, prosecution of any criminal case that the DA's office has prepared. They're not entitled under the state statute. Now, I know that doesn't address the constitutional concern, but the state, under state law, this trial court judge
wouldn't
was not permitted to give that
information. Trump the state law if it's not?
So the only way that this court could overrule the district court is if you find, Justice Douglas, that this defendant had a constitutional right to the information regarding the potential juror, whatever that information was. Now, we know under Batson that a defendant does not have a constitutional right to have a jury composed of any particular race, whether it's one particular person or to have the whole jury composed of people of a certain ethnic background.
My issue's not Batson, maybe someone.
No, I'm leading up to that. Given that you don't have a constitutional right to any particular juror of an ethnic background, it would logically follow that you don't have a right to have anybody sit as a juror who has any other particular characteristic either, such as a particular background, particular profession, a particular income. So if that's true, then we don't see how there's any constitutional right to the information regarding those particular characteristics that you don't have a constitutional right for someone to have to sit on a jury. That would be our constitutional position on that. The United States Supreme Court has told us that a defendant does not have a constitutional right to an open file policy or an open file of the district attorney. He doesn't have a constitutional right to all information that might be helpful to him. He doesn't have a constitutional right to all police investigatory work done by the police or the district attorney's office. And the court has ruled that as a matter of due process.
The court has also made other rulings, counsel, which I'm very aware of. And everyone in the room should understand that history is not just a criminal history, but if you're in the system for work cards or other information, that's also included in your scope printout. So that's kind of, I have a problem because it kind of tilts the playing field with the information. Some of it may be gathered by private investigators that they would have, but others it is a little more difficult to ascertain on a short setting, depending on when that juror veneer list of potential jurors is provided to opposing counsel.
I thought of another thing too. You know, the right to due process is referred to as the right to notice, an opportunity to be heard. There's fundamental fairness that's talked about in the decisions. It seems to me when you're talking about jury background information of jurors, you're talking about not the fundamental fairness of the trial itself. You're not talking about...
Why are you not when you put the prosecution potentially in a better position to ask questions of potential jurors to disqualify or qualify? Because if I understand from reading the briefs, that was one of the assertions that for one particular juror, it put the prosecution in a better posture to ask certain questions.
You may be referring to Ms. Lazaro. I don't remember any juror who had a criminal history issue. I'm not saying that's not the case. Ms. Lazaro had a son who was in jail, and this is where they tried to tie the Batson claim in with the idea that we should have been given this information about the jurors. Ms. Lazaro had a son who was in jail. We were prosecuting him. The prosecutor was confident, probably regarding some type of gang crime. He was a meth user. Ms. Lazaro, as a potential juror, had visited him in jail. These things came out during voir dire. The defense had a chance. In fact, the court invited the defense to ask her about these issues, and the defense declined. So whether the information came out before trial or during the voir dire process, at least in this case, it didn't make any difference because it came out. And the defense declined the opportunity to question Ms. Lazzaro about that issue.
It's a slippery slope because all of a sudden you're doing one of the things they tell you not to do, and you're asking questions that you don't know the answers to.
The defense argument in relation to that was that because we weren't given that information, because the state had it, and because the state relied on it, the district court's order denying the defense that opportunity created Batson error. That's the argument that they presented. And the problem with that is the very information that was supposedly not known by the defense was a race-neutral reason. As you know, under Batson, the prosecutor has to give a race-neutral reason if he challenges a potential juror, and that potential juror is of an ethnic background that seems to be excluded, in that case, by the prosecution. So they got that information. It's a non sequitur to say, because of the district court order, Batson error occurred because the state then used that information that it held to itself to discriminate against a potential juror. That just doesn't follow. There's a disconnect there. So, Justice Douglas, if you look at these United States Supreme Court cases, Kyles versus Whitley, Moore versus Illinois, and United States versus Bagley, they're cited in my brief. They, in essence, say that there is no due process right for a defendant to require the state to give him all of this juror background information. They don't hold that specifically, but in essence, that's what the holdings get to, because they say, you know, look, the state doesn't have to turn over everything. The state, under the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution, has to turn over exculpatory evidence, evidence that's helpful to the defense in terms of guilt or punishment. In this state, there's also statutory rules of what we have to turn over. We have to turn over the defendant's statements or statements of other witnesses the state's going to use in its case in chief. We have to turn over evidence, documents, papers, reports, things like that we're going to use in our case in chief as well. But we don't have to turn over according to the statute. In fact, the statute prohibits turning over this type of evidence.
Thank you, Mr. Planner. Ms. Liu, your rebuttal?
On the topic of the information regarding the jury selection, in the motion that was filed by my office for jury panel information, it does discuss how prosecutors do routinely run criminal history background checks on the jurors, which we don't have access to as easily as the prosecutor's office. I'd be happy to provide supplemental briefing over what type of information that we get, but it has waxed and waned depending on the prosecutor. We have cases where the prosecutor has handed over the jury panel information.
But are you unable to get that information independently, or do you have investigators that can in fact get that information for you, and it's just a matter of perhaps it's inconvenient?
Well, we have, our office has two investigators. One investigator was assigned to this case. It's very difficult for us to get information on criminal histories for anyone out of state, and just looking at the individual, for us to be able to even search relatives, in the case of Mrs. Lazzaro, it was her son, being in custody, that would be a momentous task for our small office to be able to do. The district attorney's office has access to NCIC through their computer system. We actually don't even get our own criminal defendant's background information or past prior criminal history unless we ask the prosecutor's office for it. So when we get a new case, we go to the first hearing. We have to ask the prosecutor, what is our client's criminal background history, because we don't have the full history. And they'll show it to us. They used to provide it to us. That changed again recently, and now they can only verbally tell us and show us, but they won't provide us a hard copy. We used to get a hard copy, but now they're saying that disclosure violates federal law. So again, it has waxed and waned with what information we get. And I would be more than happy to provide a supplemental briefing on that. And I think Justice Douglas definitely was completely accurate when we're talking about fundamental fairness and fair footing here. In regards to Ms. Lazzaro, in her case, The DA asked a specific question, which was in a transcript page 314, where she asked Ms. Lazaro, quote, have you had any contact or any of your family members or anybody have contact with my office? Juror Lazaro said, I don't know, I don't remember. Later on, when the prosecutor was asked to justify the race-neutral explanation for striking Ms. Lazaro from the jury panel, she stated, in addition, the state is aware that she has, and that's why I posed the question to her, she has gone to the jail and visited probably her son, I'm not exactly who it is, who's involved in an ATAC case involving guns and drugs, and so based on that, the state is seeking to exclude her. That was additional information that prosecutor presented at that point in time that the defense counsel had no knowledge of. And so that's why, in our opinion, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court has stated that lawyers wish to know as much as possible about prospective jurors so that they can ensure a selection of jurors who at least have an open mind about the case, and that's language from Batson.
Ms. Liu, other than the information about Ms. Lazaro, do you maintain that there were any other members of the veneer for which you didn't receive information for which you sustained a prejudice?
I believe it was mainly on Mrs. Lazaro because at that point she was the third Hispanic juror that was removed from the jury pool, and that left one Hispanic juror left to serve.
Do you agree that even if this court were to adopt your position about fundamental fairness and the exchange of information about the veneer, that the defense must demonstrate prejudice when that isn't provided, as reflected in the Vermont opinion, for example?
Well, Your Honor, to be, I would have to actually disagree. I think the defense should be placed on an equal footing with the prosecutor as with the state as much as possible.
So you would treat the failure to provide the information as a structural error akin to a Batson result? Because even in Brady violations, we don't do that.
That's true, Your Honor. I believe the dicta from Batson and Brady would basically go along the lines of our argument that the information would be necessary to the defense in being able to be on a level playing field with the state, and in that regard, we would find that it would be a violation.
Would you concede, just on a final thought, would you concede that if we were to require disclosure of veneer member information, we would be in with the minority of the jurisdictions rather than the majority?
To be perfectly honest, Your Honor, I don't know the minority and majority, and I would be more than happy to brief that issue.
I'm going to give you that opportunity, Ms. Liu. You're out of time. So I'm going to have you file a supplemental brief on this issue. I'll give you 10 days to file that, and I'll give Mr. Plater 10 days to respond after that. And there'll be no reply, just the brief, just on that issue of the information that should be supplied. To defense. Pardon me?
I did read the footnote.
Well, let me give her, not that particular issue. What I'm talking about is the whole issue of what she asked for originally, supplemental briefing on what is supplied.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Is there a page limitation?
Could you do it in about 10 pages, please?
Okay.
Mr. Plater, could you do it in about 10 pages?
Thank you.
Make this quick. I don't want to make it a burden. So the case would not be submitted until such time as we receive it. Ms. Liu, Mr. Plater, thank you very much for your arguments. Magnificent arguments, good briefs. Let's give them a round of applause.